It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A week ago, the Wisconsin Supreme Court released two major rulings.
The court reinstated ballot drop boxes, overturning a ruling from the court 2 years ago. In another case, the court ruled against so-called legislative vetoes, where lawmakers pass funding bills, but legislative committees oversee how that money is spent. The case in question involved funding for land stewardship programs.
Rob Yablon joins us now for a look at those rulings. He's an associate professor of law at UW-Madison and a faculty affiliate with the Elections Research Center. He's the faculty co-director of the State Democracy Research Initiative. Rob, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good to be with you.
All right. Drop boxes back. 4-3 vote, overturning a 4-3 vote from a couple of years ago. Rob, what was the reasoning from the new-ish majority now for ruling in favor of drop boxes?
Well, this is a statutory interpretation case. And the question is whether the election laws that we have on the books in Wisconsin give a local clerk the discretion to decide whether to have drop boxes. So it's really, how are we reading these statutory provisions? 2 years ago, four of the members of the Wisconsin Supreme Court thought that the statutes didn't authorize drop boxes. We've had a change in the court's composition, and now there are four members that read those statutory provisions differently and say that properly understood, those statutes, which generally do recognize the decentralized nature of election administration in Wisconsin, give a lot of authority to local clerks to make these decisions, allow clerks to decide how they would like to receive absentee ballots, including through drop boxes, if they would like.
Rob, as I understand it, state law doesn't say you can't have drop boxes. It also doesn't specifically say clerks can have drop boxes. Open to interpretation, I think reasonable arguments on either side.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why this has been disputed for the past couple of years. You know, 2 years ago, the court essentially drew a negative inference from the fact that state law doesn't affirmatively authorize drop boxes. And this time around, a majority of the justices thought that that negative inference is inappropriate, that we don't spell out everything in the election statutes. Instead, the statutes provide a framework, and clerks work within that framework and have some discretion to act. And so you wouldn't expect the statutes to specify every way in which a clerk may or may not be able to accept a ballot. Drop boxes, they say, fall within the statutory language for what a clerk can decide to do in terms of getting those absentee ballots back from voters.
Let's talk timing, Rob. August primaries coming up, November election. Sometimes courts are a little leery of making changes to election law, issuing rulings that'll change the function of elections too close to elections. Was that a factor here at all?
You know, it didn't really explicitly factor into the written decision from the court. Maybe part of the reason for that is that the Elections Commission itself, and there were also clerks who filed an amicus brief in this case supporting the return of drop boxes. So maybe they thought, you know, if the election administrators are saying that we can bring these back and there's time to do it, the court wasn't going to be so concerned about that. And we have seen since the decision just yesterday, the Wisconsin Elections Commission did issue new guidance for clerks with best practices for how to restore those drop boxes. So, you know, there will be work to do on the part of clerks in the coming month who want those drop boxes back in place for the August primary. But that does seem like something that's doable.
That's a key point, Rob. There's not a requirement that any given clerk put out drop boxes. So if they think, OK, logistically, we can't do this in time for August, we can't do this in time for November, they can just not do it. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, it remains to be seen exactly how many drop boxes we will, in fact, have back both in August and in the fall. You know, back in 2020, 2021, there were 500 plus drop boxes in use around the state. And, you know, we don't know yet what those numbers will look like this year.
Let's talk a little bit about the politics surrounding this, Rob. We had drop boxes a lot of times in rural counties in Wisconsin for a while. Along comes COVID. They get much more popular. People were worried about the speed of the mail in the 2020 elections. Republicans criticized it. There were claims, I think all debunked at this point, that drop boxes were rife with the potential for abuse. Talk a little bit about the political argument in the backdrop of this court ruling.
Right. I mean, this issue did get politicized in 2020. You're right that there were drop boxes even before 2020. There have been drop boxes in a variety of communities around the state, particularly in rural communities. Drop boxes can serve an important purpose because there you often just have part-time clerks. So the office hours aren't available for people as much. And so there's a real convenience factor with drop boxes. But nevertheless, around 2020, there were concerns that were raised, most of which, as you say, have now been debunked about the security of drop boxes and so on. But that's been persistent. And, you know, I think that there will be a subset of Wisconsinites, a minority, but maybe a vocal minority, that do have continued concerns about whether these drop boxes introduce the possibility of security or election integrity issues. You know, I would hope that in the coming months, you know, some of those folks are just able to try to work constructively with local clerks to talk to them about the safeguards that are in place for drop boxes. I think they'll find that clerks around the state really are open to having that kind of constructive dialogue, that clerks really do want to have a secure and trusted system, and they want people to be confident in that system. But, you know, that this has become politicized, and that has persisted since 2020.
We're talking about two recent decisions from the Wisconsin Supreme Court with Robert Yablon, Associate Professor of Law at UW-Madison, faculty affiliate with the Elections Research Center. Let's check out this other decision now, Rob. 6-1, so not the usual partisan split. The state Supreme Court issued a ruling. This is a case involving Governor Evers, the state legislature's currently Republican-controlled Joint Finance Committee, over who gets to make decisions about funding for a land stewardship project. A little more complicated than this ballot drop box. Can you explain what's at stake here?
Sure. So this is a little bit more complicated. This one is a constitutional case rather than a statutory case like the drop boxes case. And the question was whether the way that the legislature kind of steps in to decisions that the executive branch is making under this stewardship program violate the state constitution's separation of powers principle. So the way that you normally think government works with our multiple branches is that the legislature makes decisions to appropriate funds. They pass a budget. And at that point, it becomes the executive branch's job to administer the funded programs and to decide exactly how the money gets spent. And so this case specifically involved a program called the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program, created 35 years ago to help the state acquire land for outdoor recreation and environmental protection. And in the current budget, there's something like $33 million that have been allocated for land acquisition projects. And the way that it works is the DNR then makes specific land acquisition decisions. But the catch is that under the law, the DNR then has to notify a particular legislative committee, the Joint Committee on Finance, whenever it plans to make certain expenditures or other decisions. And that committee essentially had veto authority, right? So they got to decide whether these specific projects could go forward or not. And the challenge and the argument was this violates the separation of powers principle. This is the legislature stepping in and improperly trying to execute the law, which is normally the executive branch's job. As you say, this was a 6-1 ruling. Justices across the ideological spectrum agreed that this arrangement is unconstitutional.
This case involved that Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Fund. Does it set a precedent for other stuff? Because this isn't the only case where this kind of authority has ended up in the hands of joint finance, or in some cases, I think, other legislative committees.
Yeah, you're exactly right. So this case specifically involved that one program, but the case certainly has much broader implications. There are dozens and dozens of Wisconsin statutes that give the Joint Committee on Finance these veto powers, and the decision from the court is written broadly enough to really call all of those powers into question and suggest that really the proper balance of power in our system is that the legislature as a whole passes a budget, makes appropriations, and once it does it, it's the executive branch's job to spend that money, and a single legislative committee doesn't have the power to step back in and maybe block some of those executive decisions, which, by the way, is the norm around the country. You know, Wisconsin's legislative veto practice is quite unusual. There are more legislative vetoes written into Wisconsin law, and they're more often than probably any other state at this point. And at the federal level, legislative vetoes were declared unconstitutional under the federal constitution decades ago in a decision called INS versus Chadha. So Wisconsin practice on this has been quite unusual.
Joint Finance Committee members are Republicans Howard Markline and Representative Mark Bourne issued a statement after the ruling saying, hey, this is going to put the state's land stewardship program in jeopardy. In effect, if we don't get a say in where this gets spent, maybe we just take it out of the budget completely. I mean, that would, I guess, solve the constitutional question.
Right. I mean, you know, that is a downstream possibility. And we're going to have to think going forward, and the legislature will probably think going forward about whether this changes its budgetary practices. You know, it would have the option just to decide it doesn't want to fund this program at all. As I said, this program has been around for decades. It's my understanding is that it's quite popular, so I don't know if they'd really take that step. It also could create the incentive for the legislature to try to be more specific in its appropriations. If on the front end it says, you know, the money can only be spent in these particular ways, that would still be a way that it could place more constraints on the executive branch.
Last minute or so, Rob, we have a court that's flipped from a conservative majority to a liberal majority. Big picture, what are you seeing?
Well, you know, there have been some notable shifts in the court this year. The court did overturn a couple of important precedents. There was the ballot Dropbox case, probably an even bigger deal than that early in the term. You know, you can think back to the redistricting case. You know, it is because of this new court that we are going to have new state legislative maps that people are going to be elected under in Wisconsin this year. You know, that said, there also have been decisions like the legislative veto case, though, that haven't been decided along ideological lines. I believe that of the decisions the court made this year, only four of them actually were 4-3 decisions. And so in the majority of cases, you actually have seen the justices across the ideological spectrum reach at least a somewhat broader consensus.
Rob, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Rob Yablon is an associate professor of law at UW-Madison, faculty affiliate with the Elections Research Center. He's also faculty co-director of the State Democracy Research Initiative. Hey, what do you think about drop boxes? Are you glad to see them coming back, at least in some communities? Or do you like the old state Supreme Court decision that says we mostly couldn't have them? Let us know. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, dozens of tornadoes have touched down in our state this year. We check in with a National Weather Service meteorologist.
It's been very active in terms of just the sheer numbers that we've had, as well as having some of the stronger tornadoes in the EF2 category.
The frequency and severity of storms, that's ahead on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The National Weather Service says our state will see 23 tornadoes in an average year, and peak season runs from April to August, but they can occur any time of year.
Midway through 2024, the Weather Service's count is at 40 confirmed tornadoes in Wisconsin. No deaths have been reported from these severe storms, but parts of southern Wisconsin have seen significant property damage from three EF2 tornadoes with wind speeds up to 135 miles per hour.
Tim Halbach is the warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Milwaukee, and he's here to help us understand what's causing the frequency and severity of these storms. Tim, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Can you give us some historical pattern or context here for just how many tornadoes Wisconsin has seen this year?
Yeah, so we've had quite a bit of tornadoes early on in our season, I think. Obviously, the biggest one was our February tornado, which in our documentation that goes back to the 1950s, we've never had a tornado occur in the state. And let alone just, it wasn't just a low-end zero or something like that. It was a legit tornado and probably some of the most widespread damage we've seen out of any of the tornadoes that have occurred this year that happened in the Evansville area. So starting off with that one, and actually there were two that day in February. That has kind of kicked off the season for us for being one of the more active tornado seasons in Wisconsin's history. So as of this recording, we have about 40 tornadoes that have been documented. There was just another one that occurred up in the northwestern part of the state in the Medford area, where another EF0 tornado has been documented there. So it's been very active in terms of just the sheer numbers that we've had, and as well as having some of the stronger tornadoes in the EF2 category.
Okay, so very active. How abnormal is this volume of storms that we've seen so far this year?
So on average, the whole state of Wisconsin has about 23 documented tornadoes that occur each year. And for this year, we reached that by the end of May. Mm. So our peak tornado season is normally June and July for when we tend to see the most tornadoes. So we'd reached that average already before we even hit the peak. So this past June, we documented another 14 tornadoes, which is actually kind of right about normal, or maybe a little bit above in terms of what we've seen in the past. But some of the other historical years in terms of the most tornadoes, the 2005 season is the highest. That's when we had 62 tornadoes that occurred.
Wow.
Whereas a big tornado outbreak in August that occurred that year, that a lot of those tornadoes occurred at. So that's the high end of where things have been. But in the past few years, we've had some seasons where we've hit 40 or more tornadoes. 2021, we had 41 on the entire year. And then also back in 2010, there was a year where we had 46 tornadoes. So not unprecedented, but going towards the higher end of just the numbers of tornadoes that we've had.
And with those numbers, Tim, is it natural to have some of these year-to-year fluctuations that are part of the record?
Yeah, having severe weather just in general can be kind of tricky in terms of just getting the right ingredients to come together.
Hmm.
So let alone that, and then having tornadoes occur. This year seems to be that when we've had that hour or two window that has opened up for us to be able to have tornadoes, we've had tornadoes this year. So some years, like last year, we had tornadoes occur early on. We had a March severe weather outbreak that occurred at the end of March there. And that kind of got a lot of people thinking, like, oh man, this is going to be a bad year. Well, everything kind of shut down after that, and we were in a drought basically the rest of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So every year is a little bit different. So, you know, when we talk about what's normal, what's not normal, it's kind of normal to be up and down and being all over the place. So every year we know we're going to have some kind of chance for severe weather and tornadoes. So that's why here in Wisconsin, we always talk about the preparedness, what kind of things you need to do with being safe, knowing where your basement is, things like that.
It's interesting how you bring up the hour or two window when tornadoes themselves could certainly form. And I'm wondering then, you know, what are the characteristics of a tornado? What are the characteristics you're looking for in terms of the weather that make this mix the right mix that tornadoes would form?
So just to start off with a thunderstorm, there's three main ingredients that we look at for whether or not we're going to have thunderstorms. So is there moisture? How much of it is available? Is there instability? So instability is a measure of just how fast a cloud can form. So if you've ever sat back on a hill and watched the clouds rise in the middle of an afternoon, the measure of how fast that cloud builds is called the instability. So that's something we look at as well. And then lift. So like a cold front or something that starts air motions moving up and making clouds. So those are the three main ingredients that we look at for whether or not we're going to have thunderstorms. And then the fourth one is wind shear. So how the winds changed from the ground going up through that whole thunderstorm. And on the days where we have these more widespread severe weather events or different types of storms that can produce tornadoes, the wind shear typically is on the stronger side. So that just means that from the ground going up, your winds are increasing both in strength and changing directions as well. So it changes how the storm develops. So getting all that to come together while also occurring at what is typically our prime time of the day between, say, like 6 p.m. and 9 p.m., that just historically has been when most of these tornadoes have happened. And it's at the end of when the day has had its peak heating, your instability is at the highest. That's just typically when you get a lot of these situations that occur, and that's kind of favored a lot of the situations we've had this year so far.
Are you seeing the storms themselves getting stronger and producing more tornadoes?
In terms of the storms themselves and producing more tornadoes, I think one of the things we're maybe seeing is just depending on our window of when we can have these environments set up. So mm-hmm. one of the things we talked about back in February was, how do we get tornadoes in February in the middle of winter like that? Because it was early February too. So one of the things with having a warmer winter was that, we didn't have any snow on the ground. And so if we did have snow on the ground or a deep snowpack, we wouldn't have had storms like that occurred. So one of the things we're seeing is with maybe not having as long of winters, that maybe you're getting more of these environments that when these weather systems come through, those ingredients come together, and instead, we could potentially have a bigger window for when we would see more storms like that. So that's one of the things that, again, each year to year, we're seeing a little bit more of, and just having that window being a little bit longer for when we could have severe weather occurring or tornadoes like that. Over the last 10 years or so, we actually have been in a lower amount of tornadoes. So going back to 2012 to 2020 period actually was a lot of below normal years for severe weather. So it ebbs and flows each year.
We're discussing this year's tornado season in Wisconsin with Tim Halbach, who is the warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service based in the Milwaukee office. Tim, there are conversations in the academic science circles about linking climate change and the tendency for tornadoes. And there are some differing thoughts on this. What is your view with climate change?
My view is, much like much of other scientists, is just, how is it affecting us locally here in Wisconsin? And I think if you talk with any of the climatologists or state climatologists and those involved with climate research, is as we just kind of talked about a little bit, is just having a larger window for when these severe weather environments could potentially occur. So if you have longer winters, that window is a little bit shorter. If you have shorter winters, then our climate's going to be a little bit more conducive to having more severe events in the spring or even going in later into the fall. So that's one of the things we look at. For us at the local level, forecasting day to day, we tend to focus more on what happens, today through the next 7 days, and we don't get to spend as much time digging into the research. But, when we're dealing with years like this, obviously you get kind of concerned that, is this the new norm? When, over the past 20 years, things haven't been quite as active. So we hope for those unactive years. This year obviously shows that you can still have these very active years.
And then there's Tornado Alley. The Great Plains states have that name associated with them, running from the Dakotas down to around Texas. Is that Tornado Alley geography changing or growing in any way?
From what I understand, and from some of the other academics that I've worked with or know from my time in the Weather Service, is they've been doing a little bit of work into how that might be shifting. And I know a lot of that is focusing a little bit more on the southeastern United States in terms of just having more and more rounds of severe weather seasons down there. They're basically all year round where they can get tornadoes and severe weather down there. Whereas, Tornado Alley, you think if you're in Kansas or Oklahoma, there's typically a window for where they have a month or two where things are very active for them. They need to be on alert for tornadoes. For us in Wisconsin, just like them, we get the right environments coming up here. And, if that alley shifts a little bit, that's something we'll be keeping an eye on. And that's why we document how often tornadoes occur here. It's why we go out and do damage surveys and learn more about the tornadoes, so that when future environments like that show up, we're ready for it and can work with it. So for us here at the local level, at the National Weather Service, we take it day by day and week by week and focus a little bit more on that.
closer to home here. An EF2 tornado tore through parts of Janesville and Rock County, and we talked with Janesville City Manager Kevin Lawner about the damage it caused.
According to our damage assessment, we have at least 338 homes that have indicated some sort of damage. There's probably about a half a dozen that would be categorized as completely destroyed. And then we just have significant tree damage throughout the path of the tornado.
So no one was injured in the storm, but how much more of a threat do these more severe EF2 tornadoes cause than the more common EF0 or EF1 storms that touch down?
So anything that's a 2 or higher is what we see in terms of housing structures, and the wind load that affects them is much more significant. So when you get a 0 or 1, if you have a well-built house and a tornado hits it, you'll typically lose some shingling. Maybe you'll have some other exterior, like the fascia on the roof, connected to your roof, and the siding might be damaged a bit. But if you're in your house, you're likely going to be fine. Anything with a 2 and above, you're starting to lose the roof. What happens with tornadoes is it's an upward force. So the first thing that typically goes is the wind gets underneath the overhang, the awnings, anything that the wind can penetrate, which a lot of times will pick up the roof. And then depending on what happens from there, the sides of the house will start collapsing in or outward, or whatever you might have occur there. But typically you need a level 2 wind or higher to be able to start doing that. So when you have something like that occur, that's when, if you're not in your shelter and you're not in a safe location, you could be injured or worse from those, that kind of damage that's occurring. So we really try to, we do a lot of work to try to let people know when we issue warnings, what level we're at. You know, is this looking more like it's at a 0 or not as strong of a tornado? Or is it a day where we're seeing radar signatures, where debris is getting lofted up to about 20,000 feet, where this is much more likely to be a strong tornado? And we've incorporated that into our warnings to let people know that, hey, this is a more significant situation. You really got to be in your shelter if you want to be safe from this. And that was something, the first time we ever had to do at our office was with the Evansville tornado back in February, when we started seeing some of those signatures of the level of damage that was occurring there. So our goal is to keep people as safe as possible, and letting people know, number one, when these days might occur. And then number two, as the storms are approaching, here's the tornado, here's the level we're at. And these are ones you really need to be in your shelter for.
Is it pretty straightforward to figure out what level a tornado is, the tornado intensity scale?
It can be tricky. At the lower level of the tornadoes, if it's a 0, it's a little bit more sporadic. You see minor tree damage here and there, and it's kind of questionable for, was this a tornado, was this wind, or straight downburst winds, or what was this? As you get to a 2, the damage, it becomes a little bit more, or a lot more involved with the structure itself. So when we go out and we do a damage survey, we have to go structure by structure and rate each structure and the damage that occurred there. So something that was tricky with Argyle, there was a church that was well publicized that got hit by the tornado that was completely gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you look at that and you're like, wow, that's got to be like the highest level of a tornado. But when you look at the scene and how the church was connected to the basement, or sometimes one of the main things we look for is it toenailed in, is it just nailed to the basement, or is it got screws, is it screwed down? So that's one of the things that we end up having to look at and trying to figure out the structural integrity of the building. So that's the main thing we look at. And we had part of the tornado with Evansville that was borderline 3, that one of the things that it didn't have, the building, the barn, it was this barn outbuilding that was like a big metal shed that also was completely gone. And we rated it a high-end EF2. Initially, we were thinking maybe that's a 3, but it didn't have any steel beams in it, which from the structural engineers we talked to, that's one of the main things we need to look at. So it gets a little trickier the higher you get. But regardless, anything that's over two is something that's going to do some pretty significant damage.
Thank you for walking us through that. As your technology becomes more and more sophisticated to track the severe weather, is it becoming easier in your job to predict where tornadoes will strike?
There are certainly some really good tools that are available to us now that we didn't have at the beginning of my career, about 20 years ago. And a lot of the storm scale modeling that is happening now has been starting to help out in terms of just getting a little bit of extra focus into, all right, these are areas that we need to be looking at and a little bit more concerned with. The radar is a great tool. We've got some things we can see it with in terms of the rotation and debris signatures and things like that. But there are still some limitations in terms of how far away you are from where the storm is and how far the radar is. So there's different things that are being done to try to get that. In the end, we also still rely a lot on people, storm spotters, and storm chasers that are on a storm to be able to report to us and let us know what they're seeing on the ground, because the radar's telling us what's happening above the ground. It doesn't tell us that there's a tornado occurring there too. So while the technology's great, and there's a lot of upgrades that have happened, we also still rely on a lot of the kind of old school methods of just hearing from people and what they're seeing as well.
Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, I appreciate you being here.
Tim Halbach is the warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service. Tim is based in the Milwaukee office, and he was with us to discuss tornado season in Wisconsin and the volume of storms so far this year.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, meet two Wisconsin cheesemakers getting national attention for their sustainable dairy farming.
Milk and thus cheese coming off of that fresh pasture has such a special, vibrant, flavorful quality to it.
That's up next here on Wisconsin Today from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about the origins of a regional name for a chicken barbecue.
As part of Wisconsin Public Radio's Why Wisconsin project, we received a question from Mary Lee, who grew up near La Crosse. She asked, what is the origin of the chicken queue? Well, Chicken Q is a name for a charcoal-grilled chicken dinner sold as part of a fundraiser, but the name is only known regionally in the La Crosse area. Andrea Anderson has more on the mystery of the Chicken Q.
So on the count of three. One, two, three.
It's a hazy summer day at a busy intersection in La Crosse. Rooster Andy's Catering is preparing charcoal-grilled half-chicken dinners, complete with beans, potato salad, and a roll. Today's proceeds benefit a school's basketball program. Dan Parisi of La Crosse waits in line for his order. He frequents Chicken Q's a couple times a month. He likes the convenience of not having to cook and the taste of grilled chicken, but the name Chicken Q escapes him.
I just assume barbecued chicken. I don't know. I have no idea where it came up. I have no clue.
Even the professionals are unsure. Three catering companies run Chicken Q events in the La Crosse area, and they just have theories about where the name Chicken Q comes from. Rooster Andy's grill master, Andy Faulkner, says if you drive much outside of La Crosse, no one has even heard of the Chicken Q.
Not really. Even as close as Rochester, most people just aren't aware what a chicken queue is.
On one side, three pits at a time. I go down the other side and somebody threw a match in. Boom, boom, boom.
In the basement of Holy Trinity Catholic Church in La Crosse, People who've put on their own chicken queues for decades sit around and tell old war stories. Gene Jursa organized the church's first chicken queue back in 1970. His theory of how the name came to be is as solid as anyone's.
E.R. Schultz was a beer distributor, and he had his employees that would work these chicken queues when they started getting into them.
E.R. Schultz, or Elmer, was a beer distributor in La Crosse after Prohibition. Newspaper ads from the 1930s and 40s say he stocked brands like Blatt's and Kingsbury. A Facebook post on a La Crosse history page says E.R.'s brother, Art, ran Acadia Friars in Trempealeau County, just north of La Crosse. Arcadia Friars was the longtime name of a chicken farmers cooperative started in the 1920s that still exists today under the name Pilgrims. Jursa says Holy Trinity used to get the chicken it served from E.R. Schultz.
We got all the chicken from Arcadia Friars. Arcadia had all the chicken.
The concept of a chicken dinner fundraiser is not unique to La Crosse. But the name Chicken Queue is. There are thousands of references to chicken queues in old files from the La Crosse Tribune, but no accounts explaining where or how the name started. In the 1970s, Holy Trinity Catholic Church used to sell more than 3,000 chicken dinners twice a year to benefit the church and the Boy Scouts. While the church still does two fundraisers each year, they are about half in sales of what they once were. Ron Fitzpatrick took over from Gene Jursa as organizer.
It's very hard to get people to volunteer. When Gene was involved and I first got involved in it, people were here from 5 in the morning till 7 o'clock at night. Now you have people that'll come for a couple hours here and a couple hours there, and I take whatever I can get.
Chicken queues remain popular with some nonprofits still organizing them. A cottage industry started in the 1980s with professional caterers now arranging chicken queues with proceeds going to nonprofits.
Andrea Anderson brought us that story on the chicken queues of La Crosse. This story was produced by John Davis. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Colbert.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Two Wisconsin dairy farmers are getting national recognition for creating award-winning cheese through sustainable practices.
Andy Hatch co-owns Uplands Cheese in Dodgeville, and Inga Witcher-Orth owns and operates St. Isidore's Dairy Farmstead Cheese in Osseo. Inga, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Andy, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Rob. Happy to be here.
Andy, let's start with your appearance on Top Chef Wisconsin, the episode called, very appropriately, Take It Cheesy. Take us to that moment. What was it like coming out on this high-profile show to have chefs make the best use of your cheese?
It was buzzy, for sure. And it was a lot of fun. You could kind of feel the buzz moving around the state episode by episode. And, you know, we caught our wave. I think our episode ran early April and got a ton of attention, you know, new customers from all over the country. You could feel the excitement locally, and then we could feel, you know, the nationwide attention kind of shining down on us. So it was a ton of fun.
And this was your Pleasant Ridge Reserve, already pretty well known here in Wisconsin. Are you able to keep it in stock after this appearance?
Yeah, we're still running pretty hot, but, you know, it's an aged cheese. So we've got, 8,000 or 9,000 wheels tucked away in the ripening rooms on the farm. So plenty left.
Inga, you also got some national attention here with an award for your cloth-bound cheddar, the National Good Food Awards, which reward environmental sustainability, but also, as I understand it, yumminess of the food. Tell us a little bit about that recognition.
Well, it was just absolutely incredible. I really pride myself on the sustainability of my farm, my farming practices. I love dairy farming. I love everything about it. And as a cheesemaker now, I love making cheese. So to be recognized on a national level for just the love of what I get to do was pretty remarkable.
Let's get into that sustainability now. You're doing a pasture-based farming, a rotational grazing. What kind of things are you doing that would lead to being recognized for sustainability?
So on my farm, St. Isidore's Dairy, we're a micro dairy. So right now I'm milking just 4 animals. So we are pretty much one of the smallest licensed creameries in the state of Wisconsin. I'd like to grow my herd a little bit more, but this is perfect for the land right now. I will take my cows this time of the year during the grazing season and move them every 12 hours to fresh pasture. What that's doing is it's allowing those cows to go out there and collect their own feed. So I'm not using any fuel. I'm not driving tractors. They go out there, harvest their own feed. They spread their own manure. And they're also allowing for beneficial insects to be living in the pastures. And there are certain birds like grassland bird species that can only nest in cow pasture. So our farm is also allowing for all of this life to be happening on the farm.
Andy, you are also doing something along these lines, moving the cows around, as I understand it, around the pasture. Tell us a little bit, Andy, about what you're doing there.
Yes, our pasture-based farming sounds similar to Inga's. We follow a similar rhythm. Our cows are moved down to fresh fields twice a day, and we actually only make cheese throughout that grazing season. So all of the benefits, you know, Inga talked about are very real for the animal, for the soil, insects, and wildlife. And then the other side of that coin, and the beautiful part of that system is that milk and thus cheese coming off of that fresh pasture has such a special, vibrant, flavorful quality to it.
Andy, I understand Uplands Cheese, the founders there have a historical hand in this kind of practice. Tell us, share some of the history.
Well, the concept of rotational grazing is as old as rain, really. I mean, any ruminant moving through a landscape, even if it's not fenced, will eat the grass, you know, where it's most nutritious in its like kind of peak growth stage, fertilize as they go and move through the landscape, bison, antelope. What changed in the 80s was the popularization of electric fencing. So now all of a sudden farmers could shape their fields pretty quickly and intentionally and move cows in a much more prescribed way. And that allows us to, you know, manage their diet better and just as importantly, manage the pasture, the grass growth, the soil health. And so the two families that started Uplands Cheese began as dairy farmers, and they were amongst the first in the Midwest to latch on to rotational grazing and start promoting it.
Inga, I want to follow up on something that Andy said. He said not only is this a sustainable practice, but we can taste the difference ultimately in the milk and the cheese that is made out of that milk. What is going on there? How much of a difference does this make for the final product?
That's so true. For cheeses like ours and Andy's, it really starts in the pasture from what those animals are eating. So our cows are going out there, they're getting this diverse diet of all of these different forbs and grasses and all these different things. My cows will even love to eat nettles. And then they bring it back in. And one thing that the cows do is they can't digest the beta carotene in the milk. So that comes through in the color of our cheeses. So a properly grass-fed cheese like Uplands or St. Isidore's will have a beautiful richness to the color depending on what those animals are eating throughout the grazing season. And as someone who's been milking cows for her whole entire life, it is so fun to see the little differences that each milking or each feeding can make over the course of a season.
Andy, I hear about this concept. Hey, food grown in this place might taste different than food grown this place because of the unique characteristics. Is that true?
That is true in the way that Inga and I approach cheese making. So using milk from just one herd and when it's on its own fresh pasture, that style of cheese making will always give you something that tastes like the land and animals it came from. You know, the opposite end of the spectrum are, you know, larger factories blending milk from hundreds of farms, maybe even hundreds of miles away and, you know, making generic cheeses. It's very important for small producers like us to be able to compete in a big market, to have something unique and distinctive. And, you know, using milk from your own cows and from pasture-based milk is always going to help us in that way.
We're talking about sustainable dairy farming with two Wisconsin dairy farmers and cheesemakers. Andy Hatch co-owns a dairy farm near Dodgeville. Inga Witcher-Orth owns a dairy farm in Osseo. Inga, you mentioned 4 head of dairy cow right now. You think about, getting bigger at some point. What would it take? What kind of steps would you have to take to expand that operation a little bit?
Well, it wouldn't be that hard. I could add 4 cows and just double my whole business right there. One thing for me is I have to manage my grass. So as a farmer, my crop is my grass. So this year we have so much beautiful rain. So I really could be having 20 animals on the farm right now eating that grass. But it's how many do I really want to milk at the end of the day and putting it in there? But I'd like to bring my herd up to around 15 animals and expand into another silo cheese. One of the reasons I started making cheese on my farm here in Osseo was to be able to stay on my farm, both financially and otherwise, to be able to make a living on a farm as we are seeing a dairy crisis happening. So I'm hoping that we can be an example for other farmers as well.
And you mentioned all the rain this year. Well, last year, hold on, drought year in a lot of the state. Was it a different story for you last year?
It really was. But since we are a grazing dairy, our root systems go down a lot further. So we were able to make it through the drought without too much catastrophe.
I want to ask about feeding cows in winter, because grazing gets a little tougher in Wisconsin when the ground's covered with snow. Andy, what kind of practices do you use to try to get sustainable food, forage, to keep the cows going through the winter?
Yeah, we are able to grow all of our own winter feed. We graze about 300 acres with 150 cows, and that grass grows so fast during the first few months of the season, the cows can't keep up with it. So we harvest quite a bit of hay, tuck it away, and that carries us through the winter months once grazing stops and cheese making stops in November.
I want to ask each of you for advice for someone who's maybe thinking about going in this more sustainable direction. How do they take the first steps?
Call the Center for Dairy Research, housed at the University of Wisconsin, and start to introduce yourself and meet people. You'll get passed around a little bit, but there's a network of formal and informal, you know, support in the state here that wants to see small producers, you know, succeed at with businesses like these. I'm in a hotel room now at a cheese conference, full of experienced and inexperienced people. There's a lot of networking, and it's a wonderful industry in that regard. So, and there are so many resources in Wisconsin. You just need to start introducing yourself and asking questions.
And then, Inga, for somebody who's maybe farming crops, they have some potential pasture land, how would you recommend they do what you're doing?
I would find a place to get those cows out on pasture. As farmers, we always have to be thinking about what it's costing us to feed those animals. So for me, my herd, I'm not producing 100 pounds of milk each cow, but it's, you know, I'm producing about 60 pounds per cow. It's not costing me any money to produce that money because of the pasture. So I think as farmers now, when we're faced with all of these issues, start thinking about those alternatives of grazing cows. It's not only amazing for your soil and for your animals or for your landscape, but without grazing, I would not get my 10,000 steps in every day. So just think of it that way, too. It's good for you and the cows.
We'll leave it there. Inga, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
And Andy, thanks again for being with us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Andy Hatch with Uplands Cheese in Dodgeville. Inga Witcher-Orth with St. Isidore's Dairy Farmstead Cheese in Osseo. She hosts Around the Farm Table on PBS Wisconsin.
We are rooting for a pair of Wisconsin chefs in the new season of Food Network's Barbecue Brawl that premiered this week, and we'll be talking with them next week as they go up against the best pit masters from across the country in hopes of being named Master of Q.
Closer to home, we want to know how you are a master of the BBQ, and when you fire up the grill, what are your secrets? What are your favorite cookout recipes? Maybe something passed down in your family.
So, Rob, do you have a favorite thing to grill?
Yeah, brats, of course. Uh-huh. I make this shawarma-style chicken that's pretty good. If you got this at a restaurant, I think you'd be okay with it.
All right. So you don't have to step away from the grill to leave us a message or text us now at 888- 888-642-0232. That number again is 888-642-0232. You can also find that number at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today, where you can text us as well.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.